Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you Saturday afternoons here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online, kmjnow.com is where you can find past editions of the program, and also click on a link to email me and tell me about the veteran in your life that you think I ought to catch up with. Each week we visit with World War II veterans, talk about their time during the war serving our country, the service and sacrifice that we owe so much to them for. We hope to honor their service, to preserve their stories for future generations, and hopefully to inspire the rest of us, too, to live up to that legacy of service set by our greatest generation. We've got Bulldog Baseball coming up at 1:45 today, so it's an abbreviated version of Hometown Heroes, but it's fitting that our guest today once played for the great Pete Biden. How about that? I'm joined by Sho Katayama of Urosi. And, Sho, let's start early on. I understand you were actually born and raised there, right in Urosi, huh?
That is correct.
And you played at Urosi High School your senior year. This newfangled coach shows up at the school. And what was your first impression of the guy that we now know as the legendary Pete Biden?
Well, we couldn't hide from him because his voice carried a mile away, you know.
Loud?
He was energetic, and he knew how to coach. Only thing is, he didn't have enough players for the team to, you know, improve, but he was a good coach and a good person, good teacher.
Were you at all surprised when he went on to such great success at Fresno State?
Oh, yes, because he went to Vassar JC, then we followed his, you know, career and ended up in Fresno. Oh, he's a top man as far as coaching.
Have you ever seen the statue that has been built of him at Biden Field in Fresno?
No, I haven't, sir.
It's the only statue of a college baseball coach anywhere in the world, is what they believe. And I'll be looking at it here in a little bit when we get the baseball game going. But any favorite Pete Biden stories from your time there? I've heard so many stories about him. It sounds like you guys may have been a little intimidated by this big crew cut figure, huh?
Well, the first thing that kind of surprised us that when baseball came around, baseball season, you know, usually general school has white and red or red and white, whatever combination. He gave us black suit. And I said, holy Christ, what's going on here, you know?
It's a little hot in the summer to be wearing black.
Yeah, that's right, but he made a good team out of it, even though the uniform wasn't, you know, what everybody cared for, that kind of color, you know?
Uh-huh. Well, I've seen the Urosi Cardinals wear black and maroon a couple of times. Black and cardinal, I guess, since they are the Cardinals. Now, what year did you graduate there at Urosi High?
1937.
All right.
His last year at Urosi. And then, no, I won't say that, but then he, you know, we used to have a Stanford graduate, used to be an NCAA Povo champion. When Pete came in, we didn't have no track coach. So Pete volunteered, and he told us that, hey, I'll be in charge, but you guys got to do everything needs to be done, because he says, I got no experience being a track coach. So he goes out there and says, run faster, or jump harder, or get in there and do something, you know. But you don't have to stand too close to him because he can see you across the field and holler at you, and by God, it comes nice and clear.
It sounds like you can still hear his voice echoing in your head. So you graduated in 1937. We're still a few years away from Pearl Harbor, and we know how that changed the lives of Japanese Americans up and down the West Coast. I know your family was impacted. You ended up serving in one of the most decorated units ever, and we're going to talk about that. But how did you end up in the service? Did you get in before Pearl Harbor?
No, I got in January 22nd, right after Pearl Harbor.
All right, so it was actually before the executive order that forced the Japanese Americans into the permit camps.
Oh, yeah.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? How did you hear about the attack on Pearl Harbor, and what did it do to you when you found out?
Well, I kind of faintly remember that we used to raise a lot of lettuce, and I used to truck that fruit into San Francisco market.
Uh-huh.
And we got on a big bridge, and the guard there seeing me says, "What nationality are you?" I says, "Japanese American." He said, "Get off a truck." So I jumped off a truck. They tied up my truck and produce for about an hour and a half until some guy from headquarters gave this guard permission for me to keep on going.
Wow.
But I said after that, then hey, I got a friend that is a truck driver, so I hired him in my place. Because, you know, that kind of scares you.
Absolutely. Did you know why they were doing that? Had you heard about the bombing yet?
Yeah, uh-huh. So that's the consequence that we all took, I guess.
So a month and a half later, though.
Yes, it was, yes.
You're joining the service.
Then, yeah, uh-huh.
What were you thinking as you made that transition in your life?
You know, I don't know. I think just like any group that we have to join, you know. So I just had open mind and had no idea what the consequence or you know, whatever might happen. But I just joined the group and never thought nothing of it. As long as my brother stayed home and got to stay home and get the ranch going.
Your twin brother, Yo.
Yes.
Yo and Sho. And we're talking to Sho Katayama. He still lives in Urosi where he grew up. But he spent some pretty treacherous years across the pond on the European continent during World War II, part of the famous Go for Broke unit, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, attached to the 100th Infantry Division. I have that correct, right?
The 100th Battalion.
100th Battalion, yeah, not division.
We're attached to the Minnesota National Guard. What the heck was that now? Well, anyway, we attached the Minnesota Division as a combat team.
Uh-huh.
And in Italy, we joined the 34th Division.
Right.
Then when the war ended, I can't remember what division we were attached, but I think it was 34th.
So you were in pretty early with the 442nd.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Then did you like the fact that you were serving with so many other Japanese Americans, or did that make you kind of suspect of what was going on?
You know, tell you the truth, I can't remember having any disadvantage of advantage feeling at all. Just I had to be in the Army, and I just accepted the fact, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So even today, I said, how can I go through all that without resentment or something like that, because my folks was in posting and relocation camp, but we just had to do the business, and we just did it, I think.
Do you remember when you found out about that? Because you're already in the service.
Oh, yeah.
And then you get word that your family is being basically forced out of its home and taken to what amounts to a prison camp. They can't leave. They can't go anywhere. Yeah. How was that for you at the time when you heard about that?
You know, It's funny thing, because I can't believe myself, but I said, oh my gosh, now what's going to happen with the ranch?
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing I can remember was kind of come to my mind. As far as their welfare, that was, Army was to take care of, so I know there's no problem there. But so anyway, when my brother called me, told me what's happening, and he made an arrangement with our neighbor farmer to kind of oversee our property, you know, while we're gone. So that was kind of consolation news that I got from him. But other than that, I just let things go along as it did.
A lot of families didn't have that luxury. It's a good thing your brother was able to work that out.
That's right, yeah.
Did you have any reservations at all fighting for a country that was basically holding your family captive?
No, because the 442 unit, I mean, there was a lot of Hawaiians and Hawaiian kids in a group, but we all had the same spirit. We're in the Army, we fight for America, and we're going to do the best we can. That's the slogan, I guess, we had. That's why they named us Go for Broke, you know?
Uh-huh. Do you remember the first time you heard that, Go for Broke, and did you think it was appropriate at the time?
I think so, because even in training, most of us, young kids around 23, 24, we want to do what we can, but when you get a chance to kind of goof off, we used to try to goof off, but we had, Japanese narcoms.
Right.
And so they cuss us in the Japanese sometimes because we're goofing off, you know? But everything, we just followed orders, and I know I did. Never thought back either good or bad. The job's got to be done. So I think that's why I come out of this war in a good spirit.
Well, and so many of your fellow soldiers, particularly in the 442nd, did not come home, and so many of you came home wounded. You were among those to earn Purple Hearts, nearly 9,500 Purple Hearts by just 3,000 soldiers were associated with the 442nd. That's just mind-blowing. And by the way, if anyone at home wants to look up more information on the 442nd, there's a fantastic organization down in Los Angeles. You go to goforbroke.org.
Yeah.
You can check out information about the Go for Broke National Monument, which is there in Los Angeles. And at the time, I'm sure you guys had no idea that that you would become so famous and so legendary in military history. Does it? Do you ever have a chance to get together with other soldiers that you served with, or even other 442nd veterans, whether you saw them during the war or not, and kind of relive some of those memories?
Well, we have a VFW,
Right.
And I joined a club in from Hanford. That's the closest one we had. And so after we joined the VFW at Hanford, we used to go on annual convention.
Uh-huh.
And this one trip that we went down to North Los Angeles, that's when I met my teammate and other people I remember knowing in the organization. So I asked my buddy there, hey, how you getting along living in Los Angeles? He says, heck, we got no time to even worry or think about it. It's so busy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, same thing with us. We're farming, and a job's got to be done every day, regardless of what it is, have to keep it up. So we just went to done our own business, I guess. I know a lot of people say, I had this trouble and that trouble, but to me, everything turned out fine.
Uh-huh.
We all complain a little bit, but take it as you go,
All right. Well, the purpose of this show is to honor the service and sacrifice of people like you, and also to hear some of the details about the things that you did. Do you remember, show, what it felt like the first time that you saw combat? Was that something you were a little anxious about? Here you are halfway around the world. It's certainly not Erosi. I don't think they were shooting at you in Erosi when you were playing for Pete Biden, but the Germans were definitely shooting at you.
Oh, yeah. First time I got in a line, I heard artillery shot go overhead.
Uh-huh.
It sounded like they're coming right at me when it's probably 100 feet up in the air, But that scared us, so we all hit the ground. Then after banging up behind us, we looked at each other and said, hey, what was that, to me, it sounds like it's comical.
It's kind of hard to believe in retrospect, huh?
That's right.
Now, what kind of duties did you have?
I was an assistant squad leader, so I had 8 men under me, and a sergeant in charge of the squad would tell us what to do or what area to cover in the war area, So I used to take 12 men with me to cover that certain area and have one man report back to your head man, so let him know how we get along. If we get shot up too hard, you can't advance more, then we got to let him know right away, because if you can't move ahead, they can even run over us too, So we had a good contact, so nothing will happen to either one of us.
Now,
Uh-huh.
With that casualty rate for the 442nd.
Well, when I first hit Italy, we have 48 GIs in that platoon.
Mm-hmm.
So four squads and 12 each, you know. And I had 12 men, and I think by the time we got halfway across, partway past, just close to Rome, I think I only had about 7 men.
Holy moly.
Well, you know.
What? How? That sounds impossible to me to deal with that, because you have to be thinking every day that it could be your last day. I mean, did that thought ever enter your mind?
You know, looking back, I think we were expendable.
Well, the numbers certainly make it look that way when you look at the number of casualties suffered by your unit, and I think that's what gives the rest of us so much admiration for you, not only that you were fighting while your families, many of you, were in internment camps, but you did the hard work.
Well, I think the upper echelon, the white groups in charge of our group,
uh-huh.
keep going, and if the white group gets pinned back, we had to pull back a little bit to help them, because they couldn't keep push the enemy back where we were able to, so wherever we went, they give extra duties.
Well, that kind of brings to mind the famous rescue of the Lost Battalion.
Yeah, yeah.
The 36th Infantry Division,
yeah.
The Texas National Guard was at Bifontaine, was stuck in the 442nd over a 5-day period, went back to rescue them, and in the process, 800 casualties, 121 soldiers of the 442nd died,
yeah.
Rescuing 211 from the 36th Infantry's 1st Battalion. Were you involved in that? Or?
Yeah, yes. So afterwards, we found out what the score was. We said, what the hell's going on here? They're making us fight to our own division, can't rescue their own battalion. They send us up there and told us, get up there and rescue them, and that's what the order was, so we had to go.
So you remember taking part of that in late October 1944?
You know, the one thing that's bothering me on that is the Texans on top of the hill looking down, halfway down the hill where Germans were,
uh-huh.
And we're on the bottom and shooting at the Germans. We're on top. Texans are shooting back at the Germans, and some of that bullet was ricocheting. So that's where we lost a lot of men.
So you're saying some of your men could have actually been killed by the unit you were rescuing?
Yeah, that's right. I think so, because it stands to reason.
Now, what were you doing at that time?
You
were heading up the mountain?
Yes, I think I had about 10 men then, and we had a certain location that was our point. So we were fighting to that point and radioed back to each other how far we were close to that point, you know.
So you're just steadily trying to make your way up the mountain free these soldiers.
You know, you think, the general says, go up that hill, but you got to coordinate everything, you know. So one by one, as each platoon progressed, they kept touch with other platoons, so one won't get pinned back. And if we get too far ahead, you know, we can get pinned in too, because we got no backup beside us. So, yeah, we was well cornered, and people are dying or get hit, and got to keep going.
Now, they had been trapped there since October 24th, 1944. You guys, the 442nd, arrived October 26th, 1944. It wasn't over till October 30th. So we're talking about 5 days.
Shooting.
Wait, do you sleep at all?
We have to sleep. Well, they quit shooting it, we quit shooting at them.
But I imagine you don't sleep that well.
Oh, yeah, we got maybe 25% of us on alert.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, something like that, you know, they can sneak in middle of the night, so we got to have at least 25% of our strength be alert.
I'll tell you what, Show, we need to hit our first commercial break here, but when we come back, I want to hear more about the rescue of that lost battalion and the rest of your time in the service and what it means to you now.
Okay.
Your service certainly means the world to us. We appreciate you being with us. We'll be right back with more of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you are listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Okay, continuing on now with Sho Katayama and the rescue of that lost battalion. For those of you who don't know, this is a situation where 211 members of the 36th Infantry's 1st Battalion, 141st Infantry, which had been surrounded by German forces in the mountains since October 24th, was rescued by the 442nd, which in the process suffered 800 casualties, including 121 soldiers killed in action. So 121 Japanese-American soldiers were killed in the rescue of 211 primarily white soldiers. Sho Katayama was involved in that. You heard him describe some of it. Now, 5 days, did it feel like it was about 5 years by the time that finally ended? What, did it seem a lot longer than it actually was?
You know, it felt funny because we couldn't advance. All this time, we were advancing. Not many times that German resisted us and pushed us back. So we went up there and hit the line, and we couldn't do nothing. We just had to shoot, trying to move ahead, and too much machine gun fire or whatever, so we had to back down to get a cover, you know? So it was just a cat-mouse game where had to advance a little bit and lose half the ground you advanced. But they were well fortified. I don't remember how many Germans were there, but we couldn't move them until finally, I think, we had more reserve. I think they brought in a reserve. I don't remember correctly, but I heard they brought in reserves just in case we had to pull back.
Mm-hmm. But you weren't pulling back. You don't earn the nickname Go for Broke by pulling back. When you finally heard that it was over, that the Germans had given up, and you had rescued that lost battalion, what did you do? What did that mean to you?
Just, oh my gosh, what a relief. We go home and take it easy and have a good night rest. I mean, to me, it was just like a job, you know, Paul, and never gave it too much thought about being tired or angry or whatever. I just took it as a job and done what I was told.
Something tells me that when 121 soldiers in the 442nd are killed in that small campaign, some of those 121 were somewhere near you. How often do you remember losing some of the guys serving right there in your squad?
You know, I don't think we lost a man, my squad.
No?
My battalion, sure, but then yeah. My squad, I don't think we lost a man except one. I think one of my boys got wounded, I think the second night out.
Mm-hmm.
So we were pretty well in contact, so there was no misery or worry about, you know, because we was 100% strong yet. But the other, I guess in the middle, probably A Company, Able Company, lost a lot of men because they took the brunt of the fight, because we were on the outside where they took the middle, you know.
And when you heard that was over, you told me you went ahead and sat on the ground, closed your eyes?
Yeah, what a relief.
Uh-huh.
And we nothing to celebrate, you know, I mean, you think you'd celebrate, huh? But no, we were all tired. We didn't give a darn whatever happened after that. We're through for that day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, constantly 4 or 5 nights of fighting, you get weary and tired and get to a point where you don't feel nothing.
I can only imagine what that must have felt like. Now, you mentioned some of your friends being wounded. You were wounded a couple times, once before you ever got to that wild mountain where you battled the Germans to free the lost battalion. Tell us about when you were first wounded.
Well, we got into France, and we come to the first big city. What was it, Warmbag, whatever it was. Anyway, I understand German had like a area command post in that town.
Mm-hmm.
And we came in, and and run them out of town. Because they were, you know, persecuted by German for all that wartime.
Right.
And we run them out. So most of us went ahead of the city, because you don't sit in town if you, you know, when you're in a battle. You go out to protect yourself in the open, you know?
Right.
And so after the war, the people in that town appreciated that we run the Germans out so easily that we made a commitment between here, was Reedley Group here in Fresno County.
Uh-huh.
A couple of boys got together with people from that city. I forgot the name of that town now, but Wemberg, or whatever it was, anyway.
That's neat.
I forgot the name, but anyway, the boys from Reedley used to go to annual convention.
Huh.
They come one year, and our boys went there. And that went on for years and years.
Well, that must have made you feel special to have had a hand in liberating that town. But that's where you were wounded?
No. Right after that,
uh-huh.
We got positioned to... up to there's a railroad track where in that town, out mm-hmm. of that town, and we were told to wait until we go cross the railroad track and invade that German position, understand the railroad track. So we got in position waiting for to go, and in the meantime, our battery, you know, the artillery was pounding the hell out of that German position, and all of a sudden, we heard a rustle, and you know, on the railroad bank, there's rocks, huh?
Right.
So we could hear those rocks getting stepped on, and all of a sudden, there's five guys cross over that railroad ties, and right in front of me, and I have a buddy, so I tell him, shoot the one on the right. And he just froze, so I got bang, 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 and I knocked five of them down.
Holy moly.
And the fifth one, he was moaning, so I made that guy down there to go down there and relieve him, you know?
Right.
And he didn't want to do it, so I just pointed my rifle at him. I said, get down there, because I was in charge anyway.
And after he saw what you just did, I guess he didn't mess with you.
So it's kind of comical the way it turned out, but, it's amazing. I couldn't shoot that fast on target, I don't think ever, but I did. You know, you got eight rounds of M1.
An M1, uh-huh. You must have had a quick finger and quick hands and good aim.
Well, you know, on the farm, you do a lot of shooting, and even in training, I was a marksman, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, that's amazing. To this day, I can't believe I did that.
And this was right, and you got wounded how long after that?
About 2 days later.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big break, because went to field hospital, and nurses take care of you for a little wound I had.
And what was the wound? Where'd you get hit?
The shrapnel from their artillery round hit us, and I got, you know, your hands on your rifle.
Uh-huh.
So my hand and my arm got shrapnel, and I got a piece of one in my neck.
Ooh.
So I went back to first aid, and then went to hospital. And you know what? I hate to say this, but I hate Red Cross.
Why is that?
There's a Red Cross lady there, you know, in the hospital helping the GIs, and I got wounded in my right arm, so I can't write. So I asked her a dozen times, please write me one short letter so my wife back home won't worry, you know? In the morning, I think about 6 days I was there. Never happened, so ever since then, I kind of boycott the Red Cross.
Well, every person's actions have an impact,
yeah.
And I'm sure in retrospect, she would have gladly written that letter for you if she knew. Did your wife get word, and did she find out that you were wounded?
Well, I got a letter from her when I got back to my unit.
Uh-huh.
I was in the hospital, and there's no communication there, you know.
Right.
And I couldn't write, so I couldn't tell her. Luckily, I got a light wound, but I spent about a month in that hospital recuperating and taking it easy.
Something tells me you're making that wound sound a lot lighter than it was if it took you a month to recuperate from it.
Well, you know, it got infected a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And
did that affect your focus at all, realizing that, you know, you got hit in the neck and all over the arm, and if it had been a few inches over, maybe it could have killed you or could have hurt you a lot worse?
Possibility, but I took it as a million-dollar wound.
Uh-huh. Got you off the line for a while.
Yeah, sure was. The second time, same thing. I got a landmine.
Ooh.
And that hit me in the back, and hit my helmet and glanced off a bit on my ear, you know?
Uh-huh.
And they thought that there's an artery right in front of your ear. They thought I might have damaged it, so I must have stayed in the hospital about a month. When that crease got healed, that was 100% perfect.
Huh.
But they kind of worried, so I was lucky to stay another couple weeks longer.
Somebody was looking out for you.
Yes, I think so.
What do you remember about the end of the war? When did you find out that you were going to get to go home?
Well, the war was ended, and they started giving us components, you know, ears in the Army, in the States, and double points overseas or something.
Right.
And all the medals that you got adds up to a point, and I was the second one to leave, to come home.
Huh.
Second group.
Uh-huh.
First group was, I think, if I remember correctly, it was about 120 units.
Uh-huh.
To be the first one to come home, and you earned your early return by that way.
Right.
So I was the second group.
What did that feel like for you when you got back to your native land?
You know, I come home, and my brother was here. My younger brother was home, so he ran the farm for us. I come home, and I look at it and say, hey, what's this? We never raised some of the stuff that he raised right after the war because that was a necessity, huh? So I never seen the celery.
Huh.
I don't know how that was planted or anything, but I come home and they're harvesting celery. And I said, my gosh, what is this, you know?
Well, I imagine tending to fields of celery was a lot more rewarding and a lot safer than what you had been doing overseas.
After that, about a year later, they're building that Central Valley Canal.
Mm-hmm. Frank Kern Canal.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
They were right behind us. I got a ranch about 2 miles east of Rosa, and home ranch is about 5.5 miles east of Rosa, and the canal was come right around the hill there.
Uh-huh.
And when they blasted, dynamite blasted, the rocks or whatever was in the way. Every time that dynamite went off, I just hit the ground.
Oh, I can imagine. Felt like you were in Europe again.
Yeah.
In those mountains of Italy, battling the Germans. I can only imagine. So we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I want to ask you, what does it mean to you now when you see the accolades for the 442nd, knowing that unit alone received 7 presidential unit citations, 5 of those were in a single month, all the Medal of Honor winners from your unit, the medals that you yourself have received, and you are a Purple Heart recipient. In retrospect, how much pride do you have in the way that you and your fellow 442nd veterans served our country?
You know, tell you the truth, we don't even bring it up. I joined the VFW. Well, everybody was in the war, so why talk about or brag about it? So
mm-hmm.
we just took it another group and didn't figure it as a war, but just another bunch of guys from the war get together and enjoy life. There's a lot of people like to brag and talk about it, but I never did because I don't believe that shooting a man dead was... You know, I never did believe that then, but the job is job, and I did it.
Well, and I'm sure you were thankful just to come home after seeing
yes,
so many
yes,
of your friends
yes,
stay there.
Well, one thing, though, you know, what I want to tell you is, before we went overseas, the buddies I grew up with, he lived in Danuba, you know, Oroston Danuba, just next door town. And before we left, we went to visit our folks in Poston, Arizona. And there, he's the one that brought it up, says, hey, show, we're going to go together overseas, and we'll be fighting together, but just one of us don't come back, get killed. Would you spend a little time checking up to see what happened to me if I was killed? I said, well, sure, sure, John. I'd be glad to. You do that same for me, too, you know? So after I come out of the hospital, I found out he was killed. So I went back to his unit the first chance I had, but nobody wanted to tell me because it just, when you're fighting, you're advancing, and you're getting shot at, you just get shot at me. And that one particular bullet killed him, you know? So how much more can I tell the family that what happened? But I had to tell him because I promised the kid that I would bring up as much information as I could. But
that must have been one of the hardest things that you had to do.
But that's what happened in war.
Exactly. Well, I'm sure it meant the world to his family for you to honor his memory that way.
Oh, yeah. They really appreciate it as much as I can tell them, you know.